And I, you know, back to my point that I think.
You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. And globally at WPVMFM.org.
Well, howdy, buckaroos and buckarettes.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Simon Gaitan. French President Emmanuel Macron is chairing an emergency cabinet meeting on Monday as wildfires force France's biggest peacetime evacuation since the Second World War. More than a quarter of a million people have now been ordered to leave their homes in the Bordeaux region, with the blaze burning some 42,000 hectares and advancing to within 10 miles of the city. William Denslow reports from Bordeaux.
A calmer night for first responders battling these blazes here in the Bordeaux region, but major concerns remain. On Saturday evening into Sunday, some five municipalities were forced to evacuate, adding to the number of those forced to leave their homes to over 200,000. Now, firefighters we've been speaking to on the ground say that conditions incredibly difficult to contain. Winds are swirling. The dryness of the conditions mean that some estimate that 3 days of rainfall might be required to fully extinguish the blazes. Real concerns, especially as local officials say that these fires are now at the gates of the municipality of Bordeaux. William Denslow in the Bordeaux region, France.
A terror suspect has been shot dead by German police after a vehicle was driven into crowds gathered for a pride event in Berlin on Sunday. One person has been confirmed dead in the attack, with at least 29 others injured. The Indian government has put together a special task force and is working on legislation to dramatically increase penalties for exam fraud in the wake of intense street protests over exam paper leaks, which saw the resignation of the country's education minister. Neha Punya reports from New Delhi.
They've announced a host of measures. Apart from Dharmendra Pradhan's resignation, they're bringing in a legislation today which will increase the fine for anyone found guilty of exam leaks to about 100 million Indian rupees, increase the jail term to up to 10 years. They're promising to finish investigating these cases in 2 months, which is unheard of in the Indian judicial system. So they are trying to address these concerns. Mr. Modi also announced that he's setting up a task force led by some very big names in the Indian setup who will help figure out a way ahead to ensure that exam systems across the board in India become leak-proof. But the very fact that a resignation happened is unheard of. And many analysts say that this was proof the government was worried about eroding its political capital and goodwill among people on the ground. It was also worried about how this would give the opposition more ammunition to target the government at a time when there are some key elections coming up in several Indian regions.
The US and Iran have continued their halt in attacks as efforts continue to bring back ceasefire negotiations between the two countries. Oman has held talks with Iran over the closed Strait of Hormuz. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks. Today, is it possible that the United States is not capable of negotiating peace with Iran, and that instead other interlocutors, including European leaders, must now take a lead role? The weekend saw President Trump step back from his threat to expand the conflict, with reports suggesting the Pentagon now recognizes its munitions stockpiles have already been badly depleted. Analyst Jasmine El-Gamal, who was a Pentagon advisor during the Obama administration, says Tehran knows the president does not have the political support to commit more force to the conflict.
Trump can go on X, he can go on Truth Social, he can say we're going to destroy civilization, he can say all the things he says, but the Iranians know that that is an empty bluff, and that is really dangerous when it comes to diplomacy. I think the real opportunity here lies not in the U.S. and Iran finding a way to trust each other, but it's about the role of the mediators and other countries that can come in and try to bridge that gap. And that's why I thought it was really welcome and interesting, and I hope this does happen, that the UK under this new government is now saying with France and the US, you know, let's sit down and try to work out diplomatically an international mechanism to try to figure out where we're going here.
And Britain's new defence minister has said that talks about the way forward could begin soon. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
To recap the top stories. French President Macron chairs an emergency cabinet meeting over wildfires which have forced hundreds of thousands to be evacuated in the Bordeaux region. A terror suspect has been shot dead by German police after a vehicle was driven into crowds gathered for a pride event in Berlin on Sunday, killing one person and injuring dozens more. And the US and Iran have continued their halt in attacks as efforts continue to bring back ceasefire negotiations between the two countries. That's the latest feature story news. Simon Gaitan reporting.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Patchy fog to start the day, mostly cloudy skies, then gradually becoming sunny with a high near 87. Mostly clear skies tonight, the low going down to around 65. A chance of showers and thunderstorms on Tuesday. Some of those storms could be strong to severe, so stay weather aware. Our high on Tuesday near 90 with wind gusts near 22 miles per hour. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Hello, folks. Thanks for joining us on Head Inside Mental Health, featuring conversations about mental health and substance use treatment with experts, advocates, and professionals from across the country sharing their thoughts and insights on the world of behavioral health care. Broadcasting on WPVM 103.7, the voice of Asheville, independent commercial-free radio. I'm Todd Weatherly, your host, therapeutic consultant and behavioral health expert. With me today is Dr. Stephen DeMille, otherwise known as DeMille, Executive Director of Red Cliff and Three Peaks Ascent Wilderness Therapy Programs, part of the larger Ascent Behavioral Health Programs family, providing residential and nature-based programs for adolescents in the heart of Utah, where we just were able to be together for a conference out there. Very beautiful. Stephen's connection to the outdoors goes back to his childhood in Las Vegas, where trips into the wilderness of southern Utah, hiking Zion, climbing Veo, shaped his belief that nature is one of the most powerful settings for healing. That belief has guided his career, spanning more than two decades, starting in 2000 as a field guide at Three Peaks Ascent and growing through roles as senior field instructor, field support manager, assistant medical director, primary therapist, and research director before stepping into his current role as executive director. He got a doctorate somewhere in there. Stephen is a licensed mental health counselor with clinical training in experiential therapies, narrative family therapy, Adlerian therapy, and cognitive behavioral therapy, and has worked with adolescents and families across residential treatment, community mental health, and foster care settings. He holds his MA in mental health counseling and a PhD in counselor education and supervision with research focused on nature-based short-term residential treatment, adolescent development, and counseling ethics, where he presents and publishes at conferences around the world. Outside of his work, he's still outside. Even though he works outside, he's still outside. Dr. Stephen lives just outside Zion National Park with his wife, a former Three Peaks field staffer herself, and their four children, where family time in nature is a constant. Dr. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Todd. I'm glad to be here and looking forward to our conversation.
Excellent. Well, you know, we share a lot of background. I started in this field as a field instructor as well, in a wilderness program, way back in the day. I'm only slightly older than you are. and you know, combining nature with what I felt to be something that's like, how do people heal from the conditions that they suffer from? They find meaning in things. They reconstruct their life around something that means something different, you know, and nature is one of those places that has always carried great meaning for me. It's a place that I just love to spend my time in, and it, you know, in coming into this field in the wilderness approach to, you know, wilderness therapy and healing in wilderness settings and experiential therapies and adventure-based settings, taking that to kids, taking it to adults even, and helping them kind of recraft meaning so they can find something in life that feels like it's really worth living for, that they have some agency in the way that their life is directed, has been like paramount to everything I've ever done and continues to be so. Where did you, and it sounds like you grew up in the woods, or, well, in the desert in your case.
Yeah.
What kicked you off? Like, where did you start? Where was your entry point into this field?
Yeah. So growing up, I had very little exposure experience with the helping or the human services field. So my entry point actually came through the outdoors. And so growing up in Vegas, we We don't have wonderful access to the outdoors. So I grew up traveling. We would go to Utah and California and some places that had, you know, places where we go camping and such as a family. Me and a few of my friends started an adventure club in high school. And it was partially an excuse to miss class to go camping. And we also still liked camping. And so it was like a double benefit. And then after I graduated from high school, in a backpacking magazine, there was an advertisement that says get paid to camp and hike. And I was like, I'm used to paying for these activities. I would sure like to, I would sure like to get paid to do these things that have cost me money for so long. And it happened to be at a wilderness therapy program. And so shortly after I graduated high school, went out, traveled to Utah, and took my first guiding job working in the human service field. And when I started in wilderness therapy, my attraction there was because I was working in the outdoors, right? So I was doing these 1 to 3 week long treks where we would take these groups of, at the time we would call them at-risk populations, into the backcountry, and we would provide for them these kind of small community living environments where these struggling teens could get and receive feedback in real time, have these impactful experiences, and you know, it's a place for healing and change. And I early, it was actually fairly quickly in my career, my motivation for the work shifted. I started wanting to be in the outdoors. And I quickly realized the thing that actually gave me value in the experience was not just being in the outdoors. It was the types of relationships that were being built with these small groups in the backcountry. I remember there was actually a specific experience I had with this kid who was from New York, had very little outdoor experience, came here, was very insecure, didn't feel like they could do anything. I was working with them one day. They, you know, there was an assignment they had to do. They were supposed to make a primitive fire using a bow drill. This individual thought like, there's no way I'll ever do this. We worked on it for a few, I mean, she had been there for a while, but we had really focused on it for a few days. And when that individual got their first fire, it was like a light bulb went off. It was like a spark ignited in that individual at that, in that moment. And
Stephen, are like, you a metaphor junkie as well?
I think that comes with the territory. I think that comes with the territory. But that spark, and then sometimes it's a slow change, but for this individual, it was quick. They went from, I can't do this simple activity. And it started to translate into so many other things. It wasn't very long until that person was taking on a leadership role in the community. I mean, the dominoes that fell after that individual had that first success that they genuinely believed they could never do completely transformed their trajectory. And they left there a completely different person. And that experience right there, I was just like, this is more than just the spending time in the outdoors. And so that's when it shifted for me. I was actually on a different career track. I was studying biology, wanted to go into, interested in ecology. And it was my junior year of my undergrad. I was like, I'm switching to psychology. Like, I love the outdoors, but there is something special about the helping and the human service side of what we're doing. So that was my introduction to the field and what got me started on it.
Just as a parallel, I too was like a major AP biology guy, walked into college and thought I was going to major in biology, tried doing so for the first year, realized that I not only do I love the outdoors, but telling me that I need to sit in a lab for hours on end was like, I don't think I can do that. And switched to psychology.
My minor ended up being in biology, and my research project, microbiology, I spent a year in a microbiology lab growing bacteria. And that's what did it for me. I was like, I cannot grow another petri dish of bacteria. Dish. Yeah. So, yeah.
Right. I think that we're talking today in the midst of a world that is, from the treatment standpoint, I think our world is in turmoil in all kinds of ways. But the treatment world is in a bit of turmoil. Mm-hmm. That we've got, you know, not just wilderness programs, but also just treatment programs in general. They struggle with census, or they struggle with, you know, finding families that are willing to commit to treatment, even when their child clearly is indicated for it, because they've got all this, the hyperbolic news that's out there from Paris's story to everything else, trying to kill treatment programs. I've always said, look, if you want to go and find treatment programs that are doing a really bad job, just go to all your state programs and you won't have to look very far. But they're coming after they've been coming after private pay folks, and, you know, trying to saddle them with all kinds of, you're terrible and you do terrible jobs. I'm not saying that our field hasn't had, you know, times of development. You know, you talk about this first time you went in as a wilderness guide, and you were a high school student. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, well, you know, technical skills can be done by a high school student competently. Processing skills, on the other hand, might require a little more training. You might want that person to have at least an undergraduate degree before they step into a role that they're processing with individuals at that level. So at any rate, our field has, you know, from census to theoretical models and the way that we approach trauma and all the pieces that kind of go into this, I don't think people really understand what treatment looks like. I don't think they understand the depth and breadth of ideology and approach and professionalism and all the things that you have to, that you really want to consider while you're doing this. You're a person who's, you know, invested yourself in supervision and research, your doctorate, you speak. I've seen you speak across the country. I love watching your presentations. In your mind, if you had a family that's sitting on the fence right now, and they've got a child who's, and I love to say this, it's like, well, if you had Paris Hilton as a 15-year-old, what would you have done with her? Keep her in the house? Let her keep running around the way that she was? Probably not. You probably would have wanted to do something. So if you had a family that's sitting on the fence and they've heard all this news on one side, but they're faced with this challenge, this child that they can't control, they need treatment, they're reluctant to press the go button, what is the one or two things or a key piece of information that you would provide for them to weigh in on that decision?
Yeah, there's a few thoughts that I have on that. And the first one, and just I think it addressed just a few. And then I'll try to stay as focused as I can. And you can tell from my introduction that being focused is not my strength. So the first thing that I would want to tell that family is there is no better time to seek out higher levels of treatment care than it is right now. There's no time where it's safer. There's no time in our treatment history where it's more effective. There's no time in our treatment history that that it's more efficient in providing the services that we're doing. So the first thing I would want to highlight is they're entering the mental health treatment field at a time where It's you couldn't be entering at a better time. The programs that they're going to be looking at, especially if they're working with a consultant, are going to be programs that are licensed by their state. And we're at a time where many of the states have really professionalized the way that they are overseeing their treatment facilities. The accreditation right now is become standard for mental health, where 10 years ago, you wouldn't see... you wouldn't necessarily see programs that were accredited. Where now, it's unusual to see a program that's not accredited, right? And so the bar has just been risen, and part of that has come from the outside pressures, and part of it has come like the mental health field. If like at any given point, if you look back 30 years, you'd look back and be like, man, we've grown a lot. It's because mental health is one of those fields that is improving, and it's improving in a pretty significant and exponential way. The other thing, and it did, so one thing I'd want to tell that family is there the treatment field is at kind of its prime right now. And my guess is in 20 years, like it'll be better, but that's one of the cool things about this field is one is you're seeking help, but probably the best that the mental health field has been. The other thing I would want to tell them is early intervention, you're going to have better impact. The earlier you can intervene, the greater impact you'll have. Not only that, the more options you'll have, the longer, the longer the distress or dysfunction continues, the more ingrained those behaviors have, the harder it is to disrupt, the harder it is to intervene. There's a saying in some treatment areas that, you know, somebody needs to hit rock bottom before they're willing to train. That's only true if you wait too long. Like, if you can intervene soon, you don't have to get to that rock bottom. You don't have to wait for that individual to be in the hospital fighting for their life before they'll become willing to seek treatment. The other thing is there's a little bit of a narrative out there about the higher levels of care, the residential, the inpatient, that those are, there's like this pushback and saying like, hey, those aren't necessarily needed. All of these things could be treated in a community mental health setting. That is absolutely not true. The experts, the professional societies do not agree with that. That is coming from your social media, but it is not coming from the experts. You know, if somebody needs a higher level of care, needs a residential or an inpatient setting, get them the level that they need. Like, don't
the right level of care, you know?
Yes, get them the right level of care. Get them, match it. One of the worst things you can do is to underserve that individual, because then they're going to have treatment failures. And that will make it harder later when they have a history of treatment failures.
And then they're going to think that treatment doesn't work. And they've got this kind of trauma related to treatment and everything else. We see a lot of families that have got something like that, where they tried to do something that was not enough. It didn't work. And then, they've got this idea about what treatment is, except they've never really, they've gone to Reddit and social media to understand what they're supposed to do. They've not actually consulted with a professional who knows the full breadth and spectrum of treatment. And now they're faced with a situation that things have gotten worse. But what you're saying about, start now, don't wait. You don't have to be in a crisis. It's true across, there's not a condition in the world that's not that's not true. It's like, the earlier you catch it and treat it, the better off you're going to be.
Yeah.
Let's take it another level though. And this is, I want you to be able to speak to this, because while the treatment industry itself has been taking some heat, the wilderness, wilderness and outdoor based experiential programming has taken the most heat, The focus has been, even in the news recently, we saw Provo Canyon, lost their license and had to close and everything else. And, they've been fighting that battle, and I don't think particularly well, for a long time. And there's, you can find bad actors just like you can in any field, which is why we have standards and certifications and all the things that you're talking about. But why wilderness, you got a family, they're sitting on the fence about treatment, and maybe wilderness is the thing that's indicated for them, but they're averse to what they feel to be is the risk that you take by going to an outdoor program versus a facility-based program. Speak to that for us a little bit.
Yeah, so I'll address it in two areas. One is treatment-wise, why, and then I'll speak a little bit to the risk associated with wilderness, that or the perceived risk associated with wilderness. On one side, you have why the wilderness? And so one way that I like to frame this is, one of the things that I think wilderness does better than many of the other treatment settings and environments that I've experienced is the wilderness or outdoor programs are both acknowledging and embracing some of the wisdom traditions of our past. So, like, we've evolved over many years, decades, centuries, millennia, and through that evolution, if you look through the records, we as a species have been going to the outdoors for healing since
we could write about it, since we took a footstep, right?
Exactly. We were going to the mountains for inspirations. We were going to the valleys for introspection. I mean, we have been going to the outdoors as a healing place, and we're wired to go to the outdoors as a healing place. I remember watching with my kids that Frozen 2, when they're going to the Enchanted Forest, and Olaf just right on the nose says, as they're walking into the Enchanted Forest, he's like, Enchanted Forests are a place for transformation, or something like that in his goofy voice. I mean, just like foreshadowing the whole story of like, hey, we're going to go into this Enchanted Forest and we're all going to grow and we're going to come back improved individual. I mean, that's just in, it's just an archetype. It's just in our, we're wired to find healing there. And there's reasons for that. But wilderness then combines kind of those wisdom traditions of our past with kind of our modern understanding of change and healing. And so there, you're going and you're having these transformative experiences that we've had, you know, since our species has been documenting these experiences. And we're combining it with kind of our modern theories. You mentioned narrative therapy. Narrative therapy is a structured way for us to build a relationship with our stories and to change our relationship with our stories. And there's no better place to do that than sitting around a campfire. You get somebody around a campfire, they won't be able to resist storytelling. That's what you do when you sit around a campfire, sure. You tell stories. And so taking that, what we understand from this narrative therapy approach, and we can help people change their relationships to their stories, help them be able to identify the problems within their stories and adapt their relationships so they're not these problem saturated stories. Another reason for the outdoors is for many individuals, they've had experiences with treatment that hasn't had the impact to redirect them. Because of the novel environment of the outdoors, both in the environment, but the more so in the kind of the social setting is novel. There's just such a high level of interdependence in a wilderness program where you are just highly dependent on your community. The opportunities to give and receive feedback is outstanding. It's particularly impactful. And developmentally for youth, if you want to have impact with youth, it's not going to happen on a one-on-one level. I mean, that's the Adlerian part. Adler believed that individual therapy with youth was a waste of time. It has to be done within a community. That's my beliefs as well. That's why I've attached so much to Adler is like, you got to do it in a peer setting. If you're going to work with youth in this kind of hierarchical counseling setting, you're not going to have the impact that you want to have with the youth. And it's particularly potent in a wilderness community. Like I said, if a kid's not doing their part, the community of peers feels it, and that kid gets that feedback at home. If a kid's not doing their part and they stay in bed, society has created buffers, so the kid just stays in bed. You know, the family gets punished a little bit depending on the state. They might have the school chastising the parents about the kid not getting up, but the kid is just like, I'm good, I'm gonna play video games in the basement, you deal with it. We're in a wilderness setting, that kid isn't insulated from the impact of those behaviors.
It's Ericksonian as well, right?
Like, yeah,
you get to this we have this argument about age and development are not necessarily lining up as well these days, but you look at this kind of adolescent age, and Erickson's like, they're going to get more from their peers than they are from you. Just be aware that your importance as a parent diminishes, your opinion and your importance as a parent diminishes when they turn into teenagers. I certainly have a personal experience with that.
Yep.
I'm sure you do too, but it's like, you can't do it without having their peers around them, because that's where they're going to get they're going to get the message.
Yeah. And I love it when I'm on a phone call and I'm doing a family session and the kid goes in there and he's like, guess what I learned this week? I was doing this activity with my peers and somebody said this, and the kid says something that they learned that the parents has been telling them for like the past 4 years. And the parents are like, what do you mean you just learned that? I've been trying to emphasize that for, you know, since you were 8 years old, and now you're coming to me, I just learned it. It's like, and I'd have to sit there with the parents like, listen, you know, it's the novel environment. This isn't the first time they've heard it, but it's the first time that they're starting to internalize it.
Well, it's also an intentional social group. You know, when if a kid's getting in trouble and they're going to school, you know, they might be isolating, or they're hanging out with kids who are going to support the current behavioral set that they've got going on. Mm-hmm. You pull them out of that environment and you put them around kids who are, you know, getting professional help, being redirected, and get, you know, guided conversations and guided peer relationships. And all of a sudden that tone shifts and they start to alter, because then you put them in a pool with a positive message instead of a negative one. So, I mean, you know, it's hard to do in a home. That's part of the argument I believe you're making here. It's hard to do in a home when you've got
that. Yeah, and part of the reason it's hard to do in a home is there is something about the familiar environment. When we're in a familiar environment and we're doing what we normally do, whatever maladaptive behaviors we have, it's really hard in a familiar environment for us to experience that differently. When our parents are telling us like, hey, that's not a good idea, or our therapists are telling us that's not a good idea, our teacher, like when we're in a familiar environment, the consequences of our behavior aren't as noticeable for the individual. And this comes out of the outward bound process model. However, you put somebody in a novel environment like the outdoors, they begin to experience themselves and their impact on others in a different way, simply by changing from a familiar to a novel environment. And that's why you oftentimes hear people say they go on this backpacking trip and they come back with all of these new insights. Well, those insights come in part and heavily because of that novel environment that they're in. They're doing what they normally do, but because it's in a different environment, both community-wise and just environmental in the outdoors, they begin to experience themselves and their decisions differently, which then leads to new insights. And that's why we go to the outdoors for insights. We see things differently when we're in a novel environment. And that's why kids can sometimes say like, oh, I realized this while I was out here, versus why they've missed many opportunities to realize it at home or at school.
So my master's degree is outdoor ed, outdoor experiential ed as well. So you and I are going to, we could just nerd out on
this. I know, we can geek out on this topic.
But, you know, the one thing that I try to tell families when they're contemplating a decision like this is, I said, well, you got to remember that nature is uncompromising. And, you know, my next question to you is going to, let's talk about risk a little bit, but nature is uncompromising, which means that cold is cold, wet is wet, you know, dark is dark, hunger is hunger. And it's not going to relent. You know, you might be in a family environment where boundaries are loose and they've been hard to set, and the person, all these behaviors and familiarity are part of the equation. You go outside and it's like, I'd like to yell at the sun for setting now. Well, you can yell at the sun as long as you like. The truth is the sun does not care and will continue to set. So you might as well plan accordingly. And when you've got that, there's a reliability, there's a safety to knowing what happens, to like, hey, this thing is going to happen whether I like it or not. Now it's on me to prepare. And in that way, like, that's part of this relational message, this experiencing things different that I think that, you know, everyone, including adolescents, and probably is profoundly adolescents, get that message that's like, oh, wow, my agency is in what I can control, not in adjusting the environment, you know, not in the blaming things on the outside of me, but in what I can control. And I think that the place where they, and maybe parents will realize that piece. Maybe they think about it that way. It's like, oh, yeah, no, you're going to build skills, and that's a good thing, and independence and so on. But then they get to the point where they're like, yeah, but it's dangerous in the woods, right? It's like there's lions and tigers and bears.
Yes.
So speak a little bit, you know, for a person who's been at every level of the wilderness and experiential programming field and world, and now sitting as executive director of two different programs in a family of programs, even as recently as fires in Utah, one of your groups had to move to a different location so that they could handle those things. Like, talk about managing risk and doing therapeutic work in wilderness settings.
Yeah. So I'll do a conceptual, and I want to talk a little bit about the data as well. So conceptually, when you look at from an adventure therapy lens, one of the ingredients and one of the things that makes adventure therapy impactful is the perceived risk, right? You perceive that, like, hey, when I'm doing this rope course, like there's not, I mean, there's always going to be some risk, but those things are very controlled, and the risk is pretty small. There has to be some significant negligence for there to be an accident, but that perceived risk is important. It brings in a lot of the impact, a lot of the introspection, a lot of those shared experiences where you learn about yourself, stuff that you wouldn't have known or couldn't have known. And so there is some of that in the wilderness where there's this perceived risk. It's like, I'm in this unfamiliar environment. I'm outside. There's no walls. What's out there? And so that perceived risk is one of the active ingredients on why the wilderness can have such an impact. And I use the term perceived risk because on one side, there is risk. There are injuries, there are bug bites, there are things that can happen and do happen in when you're whether in a wilderness therapy or just out camping with your family and friends. There are things that can happen. You could roll your ankle, you could slip and fall, things like that. However, when you contextualize that risk within the risk of other activities, you can begin to realize like, okay, this the risk associated with wilderness therapy is no more or less risky than pretty much any other activity that teenagers are doing. So for example, in 2012, Outdoor Behavioral Healthcare Council published a study where they took about 10 years of risk data and they said, okay, like what is the risk of participating in wilderness therapy? So kind of the top level comment was like the participants in wilderness therapy were 2 to 3 times less likely to need definitive care or emergent care than the general population. So when you're just talking about being a teenager in life, wilderness programs had a 2 to 3 times less likelihood of needing to go to that emergency room or care beyond basic first aid, right? And so just looking at the general population, it does happen. However, it's no more and it's actually less than general adolescents needing that type of care, you know. So that's just general. But when you compare it like when they compared it to just backpacking guiding companies, you're significantly more likely to be injured just hiring a backpacking guide and going on a hike in Zion. If you look at snow sports, it was significant, you know, 10, 20 times less likely to be injured doing a wilderness therapy program than it is to take your family skiing or snowboarding. For sensational value, they looked at football and it was 140 times more likely to get injured playing football than you are in a wilderness therapy program. And I've always wanted them to do cheerleading because from what I understand, cheerleading is the sport that has the most injuries of any sport. And so so there is risk. I don't want to diminish that. Like if somebody decides like, hey, I'm going to go to wilderness therapy, there's going to be an informed consent form that family has to sign that says, hey, there's inherent risks here, you know? Risk. And yeah, there are risks. And on one side, the increased perceived risk is important to the healing process. And when you contextualize it to other things, things can happen. However, the rates at which they happen is much lower than oftentimes they get presented or people experience them. And I mentioned that as people, we kind of have this collective unconscious around the outdoors as a place for healing. There's another side to that. We there's this archetype there's around another
collective unconscious, right?
Yeah, there's another dimension here where for a long time to keep kids from wandering off, we used to tell them scary stories about the woods. So the woods is on one hand a place of healing. On the other hand, a lot of our modern media representations of the outdoors, it's usually like a scary movie. It's just like, you know, like we're going to the woods to camp and then, you know, there's monsters out there, right? And so there's this archetype that it's like it's a scary, dangerous place, and that's also baked into who we are as people, and it tends to get over exaggerated versus the realities of it, of the actual risk associated with going outdoors. It's much lower, but however, emotionally we experience that risk as much more emotionally influential than what it actually is.
So I'm thinking about this family we're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. This family that's on the fence about treatment. It's like, all right, we've covered the, if you're being recommended for treatment, you should go get that as soon as you possibly can. And the right level of care. And if residential is indicated, you shouldn't hesitate. Pull the trigger, mm-hmm. get it done if you can. And then you're like, okay, well, what about the modality? Okay, well, we've talked about the value of the modality, and you and I could nerd out on that and talk about addiction to metaphors.
Yeah, yes. Until the cows come home. I could keep going. Then, I could keep going. So don't get me started.
Right, and then we talk. Well, what's the risk? You know, it's like, well, if you survive the drive to and from there, then you probably
that's the riskiest thing you'll do. Yep,
riskiest thing you do is drive there. Let's be clear. Mm-hmm. You got in a car today and you survived the experience, then you're probably going to be do just fine in wilderness therapy. So let's get a little nuanced for a second before, you know, we run out of time, because you and I could probably just spend hours about this.
Yeah.
We get to the place where the abuse and neglect have happened, and it's happened in the past. We know mm-hmm. that it has. We've had, there's been bad actors. And even as a field, there was a period of time when, you know, wilderness was used as a methodology to work with at-risk teens, you know, and by at-risk teens, I'm talking court-referred teens. I'm talking mm-hmm. kids that were in pretty serious trouble. They were doing that as an alternative to jail, is what they were
yeah.
doing. And, you know, there was a very punitive style basis that came out of that ideology, that where a lot of the field started. It's like, you know, the whole tough love, and you're going to sweat it out, and you're going to grind it out, and you're going to be uncomfortable, and you know, you're going to be in danger, and nobody's going to coddle you, kind of mm-hmm. ideology. And you saw things like, you know, bad staffing ratios and withholding food and mm-hmm. Abuse scenarios where, you know, kids were being abused and things like that. Now, you mentioned, of course, right now there's no better time, because our field is, in general, is at its height. You know, mm-hmm. not only are we seeing a lot more people going to treatment, like there's a lot of research, there's a lot of data, there's a lot of training, there's a lot of certification, all the things that go into this. Speak to what it's like to manage, you know, and I've said this about wilderness before. It's like wilderness is incorruptible. Now you've got people who can do it badly.
Yes.
You got bad therapists. You got people that don't know how to maintain safety when they're doing field guide kinds of roles and things like that. That stuff exists and has happened in the past. We've seen it. Mm-hmm. How is it that you manage your staffing, both clinical, technical, and otherwise, in conducting safely, not only just like physical safety, but emotional safety for the adolescents that you serve in your programs? What's the trick there in your mind?
Yeah. And it starts from, so let me take a step back. You mentioned some of the bad actors. One of the things, probably one of the biggest missteps in the wilderness therapy field, was there were some very early influential individuals that came from maybe a more punitive militaristic background that said, hey, you know, boot camps are good. Let's do boot camps in the wilderness. And so they brought in justice. Some of the,
right.
Yeah, they brought in some of the deprivation, some of the kind of breakdown to build up philosophies that did exist. Some of the more adversive behavioral kind of exposure kind of stuff that don't work. They don't work for youth. They don't work, you know, for treatment. However, there were some very early influential.
We commonly refer to it all as behavior mod, right? You know,
yes,
behavior mod days.
Right, right. And so those pieces came in, weren't effective. The deprivation models were very sensational. And a lot of times when you're seeing like the media coverage on it, they're focusing on those early programs that had a very poor philosophical origin, right? Now, one of the things that's happened is those programs have moved away from those models, and they've embraced the best practices of the relevant fields. And so the reason that there are so few injuries and illnesses is because the medical best practices for wilderness therapy are extremely robust. You know, we're tracking calorie intake of our participants, we're tracking water consumption on a daily basis. They're seeing medical professionals, nurses, doctors, throughout their treatment. Like, there's not going to be a time where that kid is like, they're going to have EMT level trained staff overseeing them on a daily basis with daily medical logs. Like, they are going to be they're so closely monitored that we're able to catch things really quickly. You know, we've had cases where, you know, kids had these budding health concerns outside of anything that had to do with hair. We caught them really quick and were able to get them to the hospital, get them care that probably they wouldn't have caught as quickly if they were at home. Right. And it's because we have very robust medical best practices in our space now. In addition, we've adopted the clinical best practices of the treatment field, and so our theories of change that are happening in wilderness therapy right now are coming out of the best the best practices in the mental health field that are informing the way that we're engaging with and providing the services that we're providing now, and integrating the outdoor experiences with these various theories of change and clinical models. And so it's and so because of the adoption of more modern best practices, the services are so much different than oftentimes how they're represented, which is one of the problems that we're running into right now, is when people characterize the field, they characterize the field as it was 30 years ago, and it doesn't even come close to accurately representing what the experience is like currently.
Well, and you know, we were just at a conference together, and you had representatives of the state legislature there in Utah. Mm-hmm. I was impressed that they showed up, to be honest. Mm-hmm.